We only have one appeal to hear this afternoon. Wright versus the Secretary. Ms. Shepherd, will you come and speak with us?
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Adrienne Shepherd, and I and my co-counsel, Ali Shakur, represent the appellant, Tavares Wright. Mr. Wright is an intellectually disabled man. His intellectual disability developed in utero when his mother drank alcohol while pregnant with him, causing him to be born with fetal alcohol syndrome and a brain that is two-thirds the size of a normal one. Mr. Wright currently has two unconstitutional death sentences, and there is an unacceptable risk that he will be executed in violation of the Eighth Amendment and Atkins v. Virginia. The Florida Supreme Court based its determination of Mr. Wright's intellectual disability claim on evidence that is incompatible with the medical diagnostic framework and does not follow the relevant clinical manuals. My argument will begin on prong two, which is deficits in adaptive functioning, and then move on to prong one, which is subaverage IQ, if we have time. Mr. Wright can meet the requirements of 2254 D2 because the Florida Supreme Court made an unreasonable determination of the facts in light of the state court record when it found that Mr. Wright does not meet the criteria for prong two, when it found that Mr. Wright does not have significant adaptive deficits because there is clear and convincing evidence in the state court record that Mr. Wright not only has significant adaptive deficits.
You take Dr. Casper's testimony out of this, it seems to me, which the state courts were free to discredit. It seems to me there's basically nothing to support the notion that your client was intellectually disabled.
Your Honor, if we, assuming for the sake of argument, pretend Dr. Casper doesn't exist, take her testimony out of it.
We can assume for the sake of argument that it could be determined not credible.
Right. If we view her as non-credible, which our position is that she is, but without Dr. Casper, there is still significant lay witness testimony of Mr. Wright's adaptive deficits, both in two categories.
But there's a lot of expert testimony supporting the finding that your client is not intellectually disabled.
There is, of course, Dr. Gamache's testimony. And Your Honor, Dr. Gamache's testimony is based on completely non-scientific methods. Dr. Gamache...
I mean, what about Dr. Kendallin?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Dr. Kendallin?
Dr. Kendallin testified to the IQ prong, significantly subaverage intellectual functioning. He
found that Wright was within the borderline range, right? He found that Wright was within the borderline range, right?
He testified that Ms. Wright meets the criteria for prong one at the 2015 hearing, I'm sorry. So while he may have used the words borderline, and that's because Mr. Wright falls within a higher range of IQ scores, although the AAID D11, the relevant clinical manual, tells us that individuals with higher IQ scores, intellectually disabled individuals with higher IQ scores, actually comprise 80 to 90%. Of intellectually disabled individuals. So Mr. Wright is within the majority. So going back to Dr. Kendallin's testimony, which we were discussing, he may have used the word borderline, but he still found that Mr. Wright meets the criteria for prong one because of Mr. Wright's range of scores, that 69 to 82.
Can we go back to prong two? You
yes,
mentioned
sir.
That Dr. Gamache's testimony. Dr. Gamache, you would agree, did clearly testify that there were no significant adaptive deficits for any of the three, but specifically the one that's really at issue here, which is the conceptual framework.
Yes, Your Honor. He did testify to that fact. However, Moore v. Texas, and I'm...
Well, let me ask you this. Is the Florida Supreme Court entitled to rely on that testimony in making a finding one way or another? And you agree the court made a finding here because you're arguing that that finding is clearly and convincingly wrong.
Right.
So why is the Florida Supreme Court not entitled to rely on that testimony?
Because that testimony was based on unscientific methods that are completely rebutted by the AAID D11, and I can discuss in a moment how it's rebutted, by the DSM-5, The Florida Supreme Court had access to those manuals. The Florida Supreme Court is instructed by the Supreme Court in Hall, more specifically in Moore, when we're talking about prong two, not to deviate.
But the problem with Moore is this, and this goes to D, this is a D1 issue, not a D2 issue. D2 just deals with the fact. A fact is found, there's testimony to support that fact. You agree with that. So it's hard for me to be able to overcome and say, there's testimony that's clear and convincingly wrong. Now you're sort of shifting a little bit, so I want to make sure that we're in separate things. You're saying there's a misapplication of Moore. Now, Moore is an interesting case because Moore went to the misapplication of the adaptive deficit versus adaptive strains by the court.
Right.
And in that case, there was testimony from both the state and the defense's experts that there were significant adaptive deficits. In fact, I think the objective testing from both sides showed that he had adaptive deficits in all three categories. That's not the case here.
You're correct, Your Honor. When we're speaking about Moore, we are certainly speaking more to 2254 D1. I think when we look at the evidence of Mr. Moore's adaptive deficits, sure. He had more deficits than Mr. Wright does. Mr. Wright is a mildly intellectually disabled.
But in terms of whether the Florida Supreme Court misapplied Moore, which is what you have to show, it unreasonably applied the case to the facts of this case.
Right.
Moore dealt with a court that ignored trial court findings to then apply a standard that was no longer supported by science to get there. Here, you have trial court findings that are consistent with the Florida Supreme Court after hearing 22 witnesses and over 3 days' worth of hearings. And you have the court applying, I think we all agree, the framework set up, the three-prong framework that's supported by the DSM-5 and the current intellectual disability standards, right?
I would say that the Florida Supreme Court is certainly citing to the correct current manuals and attempting to apply them, but is not applying them correctly. Moore also dealt with, so the Texas criminal court was violating the science in a multitude of ways. Certainly in one of those ways it was relying on superseded medical standards. But what Moore v. Texas tells us was that the Texas criminal court was also, two things, overemphasizing Mr. Moore's perceived adaptive strengths, focusing that adaptive functioning analysis on his strengths instead of his deficits.
I agree, that is clearly a focus, and I think the Florida Supreme Court acknowledges that that is a focus of Moore, and that's where it should focus. But if you read Dr. Gamache's testimony applied to the facts of this case, he testifies, I'm just giving one example on page 777 of his testimony, it's at bait stamp 1547. The question is, so when you were looking at these aspects within the, I think you said the self-direction or goals, within the area of conceptual domain, did you come to a conclusion whether there were any deficits in that type of adaptive behavior, adaptive functioning? I did. What is your opinion? My opinion is that there aren't any significant deficits in this area. He says there are no deficits, not that the court was weighing strengths over deficits. He says there are none, or none that are significant.
Right, and I think that goes more to D2 about the clear and convincing evidence, certainly. So we're parsing out the D1 and D2. Going back to D1 briefly, and it does, when we're looking at D1, we do have to look at the Florida Supreme Court's consideration of Dr. Gamache's testimony. But the argument, and when you look at the opinion, the Florida Supreme Court, when it's citing to Dr. Gamache's testimony, is focusing its analysis on Mr. Wright's strengths. So for example, when we look at in the conceptual category, and speaking specifically to Dr. Gamache,
are you looking at, and I just want to be clear, are you looking at the first pre-Moore opinion or the post-Moore opinion?
The pre-Moore opinion that
that's a problem because the court was at pains to say, we got our lesson.
Yeah.
We take the GVR seriously. Frankly, they took it very, very seriously. That's even the dissent even sort of chides the majority for taking it as seriously as it did, and said we're reevaluating this completely. Here's the framework we understand more, including the part that you just said about adaptive strengths not being used to offset deficits, and said here's what we're relying on. So I think we have a problem if we're just focusing on two. And I understand your point that there's a listing that includes both strengths and deficits. But when it comes to three, it doesn't seem to do that.
Right.
I think that we certainly have to review both in conjunction, and that's because the Supreme Court, and I can address Wright 3 in a moment. The Supreme Court is telling the Florida Supreme Court, I want you to reconsider Wright 2 in light of Morby, Texas. So we do have to look at what they're reconsidering. When we're looking at Wright 3 and we're speaking...
Well, it's a vacated opinion, isn't it?
It is, but I...
Isn't it both in Florida and with us, a vacated opinion is essentially a legal nullity? It doesn't exist anymore?
I would say yes.
Okay.
I would answer that yes. However,
we have to pay attention to is the third opinion.
Right. I do think we still have to read them in conjunction, because when we look at Wright 3, the court's not really conducting a new analysis. It's giving reasons for why its analysis in Wright 2 was okay.
We have to consider it in conjunction with the nullity? Is that what you were just saying?
I think we need to look back at what they were looking at in Wright 2 to understand what they're talking about in Wright 3.
Why don't we just take it, what they say in Wright 3 for what it says, that it rested on the competing expert medical testimony of these two experts. That's what it rested on.
That is one of the explanations in the Wright 3 opinion that Florida Supreme Court gives for why it did not run afoul of Moore.
Wright 3 also says in parts that Moore did not change some of the conclusions reached in Wright 2.
Right, and I agree with the court.
I think if that's what you're saying, that you have to consider some aspects of Wright 2, I think I agree, because there are aspects of Wright 3 that say something we said in Wright 2 hasn't changed, was not changed by Moore.
Yes, Your Honor.
So I'm with you so far, but let me give you my overall perspective in the case, and you can tell me where I'm off base. Given the evidence in this record, and there's a lot of evidence to review, I think a reasonable trier of fact could have found Mr. Wright to be disabled, could have taken the evidence that the defense presented, viewed it more favorably, discounted the evidence presented by the state, looked at the IQ test in the way that you suggest, and said, you know what? On balance, by clear and convincing evidence, Mr. Wright is intellectually disabled. I think the evidence would have allowed, for my part, that sort of a finding. But it probably also permitted a contrary finding. And normally that sort of a finding gets clear error review. And on top of that, you've got AEDPA deference. So how do we pierce all of those layers to reach the result that you're advocating for?
I think when we're looking at the AEDPA deference, particularly D1, if I understand you correctly, you're saying that it could go both ways, right? If you look at the evidence.
It could have gone both ways,
both
way
ways.
Back when.
Right.
I'm not saying it can go both ways now, but.
Back then.
Right, for the original trier of fact or for the Florida Supreme Court on review, right?
And, Your Honor, I think that as far as piercing the AEDPA gateway, passing through that, when we're looking at 2254 D1, it went the wrong way. It went not ID because the Florida Supreme Court unreasonably applied Moore v. Texas when looking at prong two and Hall when looking at prong one, because the Florida Supreme Court is looking at the incorrect evidence. The Florida Supreme Court is giving unnecessary weight to evidence that Moore and Hall, respectively, for prong two and prong one, tells us is not compatible with the clinical manuals. And so that's where we get what we've been talking about, focusing on Mr. Wright's adaptive strengths.
But Hall didn't instruct courts as to what IQ test to look at and consider or discount. It just said you couldn't have a flat-out bright-line floor of 70 as a cutoff because you have the standard measurement effect. Right?
That was certainly part of the Hall holding and part of the opinion.
How can you say it's part? I mean, what is the holding? I mean, what does it actually say?
The holding is that, and I'm of course paraphrasing, that rigid 70 IQ cutoff created an unacceptable risk that intellectually disabled individuals would be executed for a variety of reasons, because it disregarded established medical practice, it went against unanimous professional consistency. And we're talking about the IQ prong.
Let me read from, this is literally the first paragraph. This rigid rule, the rule of 70, the court now holds, creates an unacceptable risk that persons with intellectual disability will be executed and thus is unconstitutional.
Period.
And therefore, period. And therefore, they had to consider other prongs if it was close. Didn't the Supreme Court didn't both the state habeas court and the Florida Supreme Court do exactly that?
Yes, Your Honor.
How could it have unreasonably applied Hall, even if, you know, we can argue about sort of the edges of what it should have done and shouldn't done. How is an unreasonable application of the holding of Hall?
Because the Florida Supreme Court, by looking at the incorrect evidence, and we are speaking, I think, more specifically to prong one with Hall, is creating an unacceptable risk that Ms. Wright, as an intellectually disabled person, will be executed in violation of the Eighth Amendment in Atkins v. Virginia. And that's because in the same way in Hall, that strict IQ cutoff was not following the science. When we're looking at prong one, the Florida Supreme Court was not accurately considering the practice effect. It was not accurately considering the developmental period that we look at ID as a condition originating pre-18. So it was.
But does Hall have a holding regarding any of those things?
Not specifically, Your Honor.
Isn't that part of the problem? In other words, there may be other cases and DSM may say this or that, but regarding whether under D1, if something is an unreasonable application of clearly established law, meaning Supreme Court precedent, we can't say that that is an unreasonable application of Supreme Court precedent because the Supreme Court never said anything regarding those two things you just referenced, right?
I think that when we're looking at D1, it does go back to, I acknowledge that the Florida Supreme Court did not specifically say that, and that's certainly a weakness in our argument. I can acknowledge that. But I think it goes back to that unacceptable risk. But even if this court says, you know what, he doesn't meet the criteria for D1, we can still go back to D2. And this court could still find that it was, whether we're looking at prong one or prong two, we're speaking about prong one specifically right now, so I'll go to that. This court could still find that it was an unreasonable determination of the facts in light of that clear and convincing evidence in the record that he does meet prong one. So we have three experts testifying that he meets the criteria for prong
one. Is there anything... Why would it be clear and convincingly wrong to take an average of IQ tests over a long course of period to reach a conclusion about what someone's actual IQ or the real IQ or real intelligence is?
If I could ask you to clarify your question, are you asking would averaging scores as in you average them together and get a mean of those scores or considering all the scores?
Considering all those scores together to reach a conclusion about what it means. So Dr. Gamache says, absent, I think, one or two scores, which he gave reasons for why he discounted, including the one that he administered, he says, I've considered all of them, and I believe that the real intelligence score is 78, right?
So, right, and he reaches that by averaging actually seven scores together, one of which is an abbreviated score, but that's completely rebutted by the clinical manuals. And we actually have the three other experts saying that's not how you look at IQ scores.
Can I ask you something? Let's go back to Moore. Mm-hmm. How did the state trial court in Moore, the one that Justice Ginsburg touted as exactly how this is supposed to be done, how did it reach a conclusion about the intellectual property score?
My recollection serves me correctly. I do think that the trial court may have averaged the scores together.
Yeah, it did.
It did? Okay. That was incorrect. Well, but that was not the issue raised in Moore. The issue was the adaptive functioning.
I don't disagree with you, but if the score that they started with to get to second prong was the 74 that was the average.
Are we still speaking about Moore, right?
We are. Was the 74 that was used as an average. So if averaging is not inappropriate or wrong in deciding the gateway to get from prong one to prong two of the three prong the DSM test, I'm just having to understand how a court gets it clearly and convincingly wrong when they use the same approach that was used by the state habeas court in Moore that seems to be blessed by the Supreme Court.
I would say that in Moore, they were more functioning on Moore's adaptive functioning, and it is incorrect according to the clinical manuals, because what the clinical manuals tell us is that each test has a different standard error of measurement based on age groups, which test it is. So you have to report each test with a separate standard of error of measurement and a separate confidence interval. So it's okay to consider more than one score. Now, we discuss in the briefs how certain of Mr. Wright's scores are not reliable because they're being acted on by certain phenomena, scientific phenomena. It's okay to consider more than one score. You should when you have more than one score, but you need to consider the scientifically accurate scores. And so speaking to Dr. Gamache averaging those scores, another thing, he's including an abbreviated score
What did Hall say about assessing multiple scores?
I don't specifically recall, Your Honor.
So if you looked at page 714 of Hall, and again, it's not a holding, it's talking about all of this generally, but it says, even when a person has taken multiple tests, each separate score must be assessed using the SEM, and the analysis of multiple IQ scores jointly is a complicated endeavor. And it doesn't cite to the DSM, and it doesn't cite to the Intellectual Disability Manual. It actually cites to the Oxford Handbook of Child Psychological Assessment, right?
I am not familiar with that last, what it cited to. It is a complicated endeavor.
So here Dr. Gamache says, he even cites exactly, and even when called on, he even quotes the portion of the scientific manual he's relying on, the methodology he's relying on this complicated endeavor to reach a conclusion. Now, his may not be right, it may be right, but how can we say that's clear and convincingly wrong?
It's clear and convincingly wrong because it's rebutted by the two manuals that clinicians in the field use, that Hall acknowledges clinicians in the field use, the AAIDD-11 and the DSM-5. It's completely rebutted. You don't average
Shepherd,
scores.
You could finish this answer, but you are over the time that you've reserved some time for rebuttal. So I'll let you finish this, but if you want to cut into your own rebuttal time.
I'll finish the answer briefly. It's rebutted by the AAIDD-11, and that would be my answer, that is the manual that should be looking at. And we also have the three other experts saying that is not how we look at IQ scores. I will reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Ms. Drake.
May it please the court, Assistant Attorney General Stephen Ake on behalf of the respondent in this case. The district court properly denied Mr. Wright's intellectual disability claim because the Florida Supreme Court's decision was not contrary to clearly established law in Hall or Moore, and it certainly did not involve an unreasonable determination of the facts. As to the first prong, as to his sub-average intellectual functioning, the Florida Supreme Court followed Hall exactly and factored in the standard error of measurement based on the expert's testimony. The experts in this case both utilized current clinical manuals in coming up with this testimony.
Your opposing counsel, though, says exactly the opposite of that. They say that when you average multiple scores or when you're trying to find real IQ when there's a situation like here, which seems to be pretty common, there's someone's tested multiple times throughout the course of their life, the way to do it is to use averages based on the SEM range, the standard error measurement range, for each of those scores to find the average. And here, Dr. Gamache, who really formed the basis of the Florida Supreme Court's findings and the state habeas court's findings, didn't use that measurement. He instead used a different sort of measurement where he took averages, and his explanation is where you have scores that are so consistent over time, we don't need an error measurement. We pretty much know what someone's intelligence is, where it's the same over and over and over and over again.
Correct, Your Honor. In fact, Dr. Gamache acknowledged that each individual test has its own standard error of measurement. His testimony was the fact that this is maybe an uncommon fact that somebody has so many IQ tests, and that because of that, it's a better reflection than the standard error of measurement by looking at his actual IQ scores on these numbers of tests.
If your opposing counsel is right, that approach, as logical as it sounds, is inconsistent with the DSM and or the Intellectual Disability Manual, what do we make of that when determining whether that finding is clearly and convincingly wrong?
Well, this court is bound by following or looking at the U.S. Supreme Court's holding, and in Hall, it doesn't address.
Well, I'm talking about D2 now, not D1.
Okay. Well, it's certainly not objectively unreasonable to consider that, Your Honor. It's the manual, first off, the DSM doesn't address that. The AAIDD, I don't believe they address it and say that it's prohibited to do an average. But I also think that if you look at Dr. Gamache's testimony in its entirety, I don't think that whole average thing was a big part of his testimony, in all honesty. He was looking at his range of scores and the fact that he got an 82 on this one test, and he said that was the most accurate indicator of his potential, because you can't fake smart. And in this case, he had questions about Mr. Wright malingering on a number of his tests, and that 82, by the defense's own expert, was a valid test score. She didn't have any complaint about that score based on the practice effect, because it hadn't been given. I think it was the first test he had been given in maybe 6 years, I believe it was, or something of that range. But There's nothing in Hall that mandates that you're not allowed to average the scores. In fact, as you just read that portion of the majority's opinion, it's a complicated task. And I believe that's what the DSM says, too. But I don't think that's pivotal to the underlying decision here that he failed to establish by clear and convincing evidence that he had significantly subaverage intellectual functioning based on these IQ scores. Even when you factor in the standard error of measurement on his lowest score of 75, he just barely got down to a 69. And as this court has pointed out in a number of cases, the standard error of measurement is a bidirectional concept. It doesn't, you don't automatically assume it goes to the low end. It could go to the high end. And in this case, that 75 yielded a range up to about 80 or 81, and that's what he scored on another test. So that shows his intelligence.
The only other one, the one in 91 that Dr. Kendallin administered was a 69 or 70, but it went to 82.
Right, right. And that was, again, with the standard error of measurement.
And those are the only two where they're even with at the low end of the standard error of measurement that are standard error of deviation.
Correct, Your Honor. Every full-scale score was 75 or above. Every single one. We had two 75s, a 76, I think 80 and 81 and 82. So, this court has looked at a number of cases.
It seems to me that on the third go-around, if we go ahead to the second part and adaptive functioning deficits, they get this, the Supreme Court of Florida gets this back from the Supreme Court. Take another look at this in the light of Moore. They do so. Whatever they tell us about their second opinion, right to, aren't we obliged to accept their own construction of their own case law?
I believe
as the correct determination of state law. I mean, we can't look behind that and say, well, I read that second opinion a different way. We have to accept the final decision. This is what we meant. This is what we said. This is what it rested on. And then we have to review that.
Right. And I believe their opinion was this is a credibility determination that the state post-conviction court found Dr. Gamache's testimony more reliable than the defense's expert. And there were valid reasons for that. Her, on the adaptive functioning prong, her analysis was weighed heavily on her ABIS testing that she had given in an admittedly unorthodox method, which the Florida Supreme Court pointed out gave him great grave concern about her credibility.
If I could ask you a question, not going to the Florida Supreme Court's decision, but the district court's order denying habeas relief. One of the things that Mr. Wright's counsel say is that the district court spent too much time and placed too much emphasis on Mr. Wright's conduct, behavior, etc., at trial, and focus too much on so-called adaptive strengths as opposed to adaptive deficits. Could you comment on that contention?
And I believe the district court also in the motion for reconsideration said that was just one portion of my decision that was one of the factors that I discussed at the outset of the order was his trial testimony, but that was just one facet of numerous reasons that the Florida Supreme Court's opinion got it right, was his trial testimony along with, I believe, his conduct at the trial. But we're here to look at the Florida Supreme Court's decision and as to whether it was an unreasonable determination of the facts. And I believe that the district court simply followed that and said, hey, this is not a close case. This is a credibility contest here. This individual is not intellectually disabled. The Florida Supreme Court found that he didn't meet any of the prongs. That is supported by clear and convincing evidence in this case.
Do we owe any deference to the district court's order?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe you do.
And what's our standard of review of the district court's order?
De novo. Okay. You're reviewing it for clear error on any factual basis.
What we're really reviewing then is the Florida court's decision.
Correct. Right? Correct. That's how I read it, Your Honor. I believe that the court's order is totally justified in this case, given the evidence that was before the Florida Supreme Court. And unless this court has any further questions, I just ask this court to affirm.
Well, I'd like to explore a little bit on the adaptive strength versus adaptive deficits. Your opposing counsel says that part of the problem with the Florida Supreme Court's opinion, reading both Right 2 and Right 3 together, is that the Florida Supreme Court was doing essentially the same thing that the Texas court did in Moore, which is using strengths to overcome deficits. If you could point to something specific, especially in Wright 3, which would rebut that, that would be helpful.
Well, first, Your Honor, I don't believe there are any deficits that they had to look at. I mean, Dr. Gamache's testimony was basically that he doesn't have any significant deficits in adaptive functioning to look at. They're not being, it's not being like offset by any great strengths that he has. It's just there aren't any. He's not at that lowest level of the population that satisfies the requirement of having deficits in the adaptive deficits, the bottom 2% of the population, as he referred to
it. Is that consistent with what the Florida Supreme Court said, though, in Wright 3? Do they acknowledge at all any deficits?
No, they don't. They don't discuss. Well, they discuss the fact that his school records showed that he had a learning disability in school, and that he had, you know, school records reflected poor grades and that kind of thing. But that was still, it's not an unlawful offsetting of his deficits to talk about strengths that were also present within that same domain of him being able to write letters, write a blog, deal with pen pals, deal with the correctional facility, memorize numbers, addresses, all that kind of information. And I believe the Florida Supreme Court said in Wright 3, we quoted basically Dr. Gamache's testimony, but that wasn't the only reason. It was also the other evidence in this case, the trial record, the lay witness testimony, the conduct of the defendant in the murder, and all that kind of stuff that was, again, a factor in their decision-making, but it wasn't the sole factor, Dr. Gamache's testimony, that is.
Did the Florida Supreme Court overweigh or overvalue prison conduct?
They certainly
in making its findings.
I don't believe they overemphasized it. I'm not really sure. I'm not sure really how you quantify that anyway. But no, the short answer is I don't believe they did. They certainly talked about it. Now you have to remember that Mr. Wright had been in prison from 19 on, and when he was a juvenile, he was in boot camp from, I believe, 16 on for a number of years. So,
but isn't the relevant reference, though, the period before 18? I mean, the whole purpose of this, in fact, the third prong goes to onset pre-18.
Right. But under Florida law, you still have to have current deficits. And they certainly discussed his prison contact. There's no getting around that. And Dr. Gamache discussed it. That's certainly true. But I don't believe it's an overemphasis because they did talk about things that happened prior to that time in his developmental years. And Dr. Gamache based it on some of those factors also. There was testimony that Mr. Wright had lived on his own and had provided for himself in an apartment, and it basically from about age of 13 on, I believe, was on his own and supporting himself. And that was all evidence that they were entitled to look at in addition to the prison. Now, I would also point out that the manuals don't definitively say, hey, you're not allowed to look at prison conduct. They just stress that it shouldn't be the basis of it because it is a controlled environment.
What do we make of the Florida Supreme Court's assertion that there was no dispute among the experts on two of the adaptive functions, and yet at least one of the defense's experts testified that from the pre-19 period there was adaptive deficits for I think it was the social. That's right.
I think it's social. Yes, she testified. She did two analyses, one before age 16 and post, and she had come up with that. And her testimony was that he had gotten better in that domain. The Florida Supreme Court focused on the current deficits, and they said the only one in dispute was the conceptual at this point in time, and that was what they based their opinion on, because under Florida law, that's what you have to show.
Was that problematic, though, if an expert did testify? In other words, if part of the Florida Supreme Court's decision rested on a concession that isn't really a concession, is that problematic?
No, I don't believe that is because it's the basis of their decision is you have to meet these three prongs, and the second prong being current deficits and adaptive behavior. And if the expert that they're basing their credibility finding on says he doesn't have it, I believe that's supported by the record in this case. And that's an objectively reasonable decision to make under the facts. I don't believe that provides any basis for habeas relief under D2.
If we had just Wright 2, do you think that it would be problematic for the state either in terms of either D1 or D2 in its application of Moore?
No, not really. You don't think
Wright 2 could be read as relying heavily on adaptive strengths?
No, I don't believe that it does. I don't believe that it does place an overemphasis on adaptive strengths outweighing deficits, because I just don't think the deficits are there. I think the court, you almost have to discuss strengths when you're discussing adaptive behavior. There's no other way around it to say that this person doesn't have deficits than to list strengths. I don't want to see how the court can get away from that, basically, of not pointing out that the expert said he has, this is what he can do. These are all the things that I observed that make me come to this conclusion that he doesn't have deficits. Whether that's an overemphasis on strengths or just a finding that he doesn't have deficits, I'm not sure where you draw the line. To me, that's very blurry, and I believe the Florida Supreme Court, some of the judges in their, I believe it was the dissent, pointed that out, that there is no clearly established law on when you're overemphasizing something to me out of the Moore decision. I find that problematic, but to answer your question, I don't believe that the Wright 2 opinion would have been in jeopardy either based on everything that happened. I don't believe that would have been a problem under Moore either, but we certainly have the Wright 3 decision, which the court, you know, clarified what...
Which is what matters.
Right. Correct. All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Shepherd, you've saved 10 minutes.
Judge Luck, I'd like to briefly point you to, in our reply brief on page 6, the question about averaging scores and the standard error of measurement. I was looking for where we had outlined that. We cite from the AAIDD 11, which does talk about the standard error of measurement varying by test subgroup and age group. It doesn't specifically talk about averaging scores, but it's kind of how we got there. And then on the next page, page 7, we have Dr. Casper testifying that there's no logical basis for averaging scores. We also have Dr. Free testifying, you just don't do that. So we do have two.
The problem is, though, there, at least on the legal side, there doesn't seem to be any clearly established law, and I think you even agreed to that. On the factual side, where it's not explicitly contradicted by the DSM and the Intellectual Disability Manual, and I have page 6 here, I have it starred even, so I understand the argument you're making, where it's not even contradicted by that, it's hard for us to say that that's clear and convincingly wrong.
I think it, when we look at what it's saying about how you have to report a different standard error of measurement for each test, that is, without using the word averaging, still completely clear and convincingly rebutting it, because you can't average scores together, because then you have to average together each standard error of measurement.
But what Dr. Gamache is saying, I mean, he clearly acknowledges the SEM. There's no dispute on that. What he's saying is, where you have a lot of scores together, we have a pretty, and where they're all in the same range, or they're all within the same band, it's pretty indicative, and you can get closer to what we're trying to get to, which is, what is your real intelligence? And that's what he's saying, and that A has logic sense to me, but even putting logic aside, that doesn't seem to be contradicted by anything. And he even cites a manual from his universe that seems to support doing exactly what he did. So it's hard for me to say that is clearly and convincingly wrong with regard to prong one.
I think even if we put Dr. Gamache's testimony on averaging the scores aside for a moment, because I acknowledge that there's no, it doesn't specifically state don't average, right? So we are extrapolating a little bit, and I'm not a medical expert. We still have three experts. When we're talking about D2 and prong one, opining that he meets the criteria for prong one, and he does have that qualifying score of 75 at the age of 16, which falls within that 65 to 75 standard error of measurement, we know it's a holistic approach. So the court did appropriately go on to consider prong two. When we combine the evidence of those two together, we can still reach the decision that he is intellectually disabled and so therefore ineligible for execution. I would like to address a little bit of what Mr. Ake spoke to on prong two. He stated, and I paraphrase, that there were no deficits for the Florida Supreme Court to consider. But, Your Honor, there are. And there are deficits that the Florida Supreme Court failed to even discuss, completely ignored in its analysis of adaptive functioning. And I'd like to put aside expert testimony for a moment, because I acknowledge that that's a credibility determination that we have to rebut by clear and convincing evidence. I'd like to look
at... They're crediting Dr. Gamache's testimony over
They are.
Dr. Gaspers, right?
And we have argued that.
So what is it that in Dr. Gamache's testimony that would suggest that he had adaptive deficits?
It's not in Dr. Gamache's testimony. It's
well,
in the lay witness.
That's the testimony they credited.
And it is objectively unreasonable for them to credit Dr.
Credit his testimony
yes,
about
yes,
that.
Right. It is objectively unreasonable to credit Dr. Gamache's testimony because he was following non-scientific methods for two reasons. Number one, when we look at that litany of adaptive strengths as separated and individually numbered, which, Your Honors, to separately number a combined 35 perceived adaptive strengths while barely acknowledging all the lay witness testimony is focusing on adaptive strengths, whether we're thinking about expert testimony or lay witness testimony.
Hard to say he ignored lay witness testimony. So as I recall, they actually adjourned the hearing, the first hearing, because some summaries of lay witness testimony had been given to Dr. Gamache to review that had not been turned over to the defense. And the judge very reasonably said, you're right. Let's only hear prong one. I'm going to give you the time to look at the summaries, and we're going to come back. And then when they came back, he says on cross-examination, I've reviewed these. He even was present for all those lay witness testimonies. He says he considered that as part of his analysis. So how can we say that he didn't consider the lay witnesses?
He also, all of that is a correct, Your Honor, yes. He also testified that he mainly relied in forming his opinion on a single interview that he had with Mr. Wright on death row. Yes, he considered other evidence, but he himself testified that he considered Mr. Wright to be a reasonable and a reliable source of Mr. Wright's adaptive functioning. But the AAIDD-11, the user's guide to the AAIDD-11, which is also part of the clinical manuals, states that intellectually disabled individuals are not good self-reporters of their adaptive functioning, particularly mildly intellectually disabled individuals like Mr. Wright, because they put on the cloak of competency.
Where are you getting in his testimony that he primarily or only relied on that? As I read his testimony, he starts from the beginning by saying, I considered my interview, I read, he even lists all the things he looked at. I looked at his testimony, I looked at all the files you've given me, including all the psychological reports that had been done up to that point. He even says, I went on the Florida Supreme Court's website to look at the entire appendix that had been filed with regard to this motion. He then was there present for the testimony of the lay witnesses. He looked at the summaries that had been given to him. So it's hard for me to say, and again, point me to it where he relies primarily. He does say that he believes that him to be a good indicator of his own abilities, but he's also clear that where I tested him on it every time. Like, for instance, at one point he says, I'm not that good at writing and reading and things like that, but then he asks him at the pen pals and they go in, and only then does he disclose the whole pen pal situation.
So to answer your question, Your Honor, I don't have his testimony directly in front of me, but I do have ground one of the habeas petition, and on page 44 of that, we do have summaries that have citations to... I don't think the citations correspond with the current page numbering because it was in the lower court. But if you go to 44 of the habeas petition, it states that Dr. Gamache's interview with Mr. Wright was one of the main things he relied on. So when forming his opinion, yes, he looked at the other things. But the problem is that he still relied heavily on Mr. Wright's self-reporting. Dr. Gamache testified that he did not speak to any other witnesses. Yes, he looked at those summaries, but the clinical manuals tell us you need to speak to other witnesses. You need to corroborate that evidence. It's not enough to read a summary. You need to speak to someone in person. We have Dr. Casper doing that. She spoke to several witnesses who would have been witness to his adaptive functioning during a variety of periods, pre-18, after incarceration. And we have evidence that rebuts Dr. Gamache's testimony about Mr. Wright's self-reporting extensively. So, for example, Dr. Gamache testified that Mr. Wright told him that he was not a victim of exploitation. However, intellectually disabled individuals are typically followers. They're easily manipulated. They're gullible. So in the social category, we have other sources saying that he was a victim of exploitation. He was taken advantage of by the inmates in the Polk County Jail because he was gullible. He was able to be manipulated, so they would hide contraband in his cell, and he could get in trouble for that. Pre-incarceration, during the developmental stage, he was taken advantage of by his peer school children because he was easily manipulated. He couldn't fit in. That's all in lay witness testimony, and it rebuts one of those self-reported perceived adaptive strengths that Dr. Gamache is focusing on. So when we're looking at D2, and we're looking at the adaptive deficits, we have lay witness testimony that he has severe deficits in both the conceptual and the social categories pre-18. But then, and yes, that is what, because ID originates pre-18, that's what the manuals are looking at. But we also have evidence of his deficits during his trial. He couldn't aid in his defense. Trial counsel testified, and yes, we acknowledge his coherent trial testimony, but that's on one day. It's not his like average everyday functioning. Three days. However, we do have testimony from trial counsel that they spoke with Mr. Wright for 200 hours, and they never had a conversation with him that led them to believe that he understood what they were saying. He couldn't understand the circumstances of the life and avoidance plea, so he couldn't make an informed decision on whether or not to accept it. And Your Honors, he has a diminished capacity in the conceptual and social categories that renders him one of those individuals that we don't execute under Atkins v. Virginia. And so I see that I am almost out of time. So in conclusion, Your Honors, Mr. Wright should not be executed as an intellectually disabled man because the Florida Supreme Court looked at the wrong evidence. And so we respectfully request that this court grant relief. Thank you.
Thank you.
We are in recess. Thank you.
All right.
Sure.
Thank you.